In the NHL, the Blackhawks were off last night. They skate at home tonight against Colorado. Now the WGTD forecast from the National Weather Service. For this Friday the 22nd, mostly sunny and seasonal, high 37, low tonight 29. Could be a little bit of a messy morning tomorrow. Cloudy and mild, a mix of freezing rain and snow for the morning, some minor ice accumulation. Tomorrow's high, though, 40 degrees, so most of that will melt away by afternoon. Here are the numbers now. Wind is calm. The sun is shining. 19 degrees across the board for Racine, Kenosha, Burlington, Elkhorn, and Lake Geneva. For WGTD News, I'm Dave McGrath. 10 past 8, the morning show with Greg Berg is next.
Support for the morning show comes from Carthage College, welcoming approximately 150 full-time transfer students each year. Eligible Gateway graduates can receive guaranteed admission to Carthage to complete their bachelor's degrees. Transfer to a more personalized education in 4 easy steps. More information about admissions and competitive scholarships for transfers is available at carthage.edu/admission/transfer. Support for WGTD also comes from Jack and Drea, a Kenosha tradition since 1911, newly reimagined for 2019. A unique shopping experience time and time again, and that's what brings you back. JackandDrea.com. Jack and Drea, a proud supporter of WGTD's morning show. And we welcome you to the Friday morning show on WGTD. I'm Gregory Berg. A little later in the hour, we'll give you a brief preview of what promises to be a magnificent piano recital this Sunday afternoon at 3 o'clock for Fine Arts at First. That's at First United Methodist Church in Kenosha, a concert by pianist Wael Farouk. First, though, a preview of a production about to open at the Racine Theater Guild. Here's part one of today's morning show. And we welcome you to the Friday morning show on WGTD. I'm Gregory Berg. I'm delighted to be sitting across from Michael Klickner, who has joined us before on the morning show on at least a couple of previous occasions. Michael has a long history with the Racine Theater Guild and most recently has been at the Guild as one of its busiest guest directors, although it seems funny to call Michael Klickner a Racine Theater Guild guest since it has been such an important part of his life for just about longer than anybody I know, as a matter of fact. We'll touch on that in just a moment. But what we mostly want to talk about today is the production at the Guild that is opening tonight and running for the next several weekends. And the play is Wait Until Dark by Frederick Knott. And I suspect that many of you know, as I do, the classic film of the play made by that starred Audrey Hepburn. But this was first a stage play and a very successful one, and one that has been revived any number of times. And it's actually been done at the Racine Theater Guild before. I'm not sure how many years it's been, but it is back on the stage of the Guild, and Michael Klickner is directing it. And he joins me today on the morning show to talk about this production. Michael Klickner, we welcome you back to the morning show.
Thank you. Good morning, everybody.
Great to have you here.
Thanks.
Ahead of us talking about Wait Until Dark, I kind of touched on the fact in the introduction that you and the Racine Theater Guild go back an awfully long way. Explain to our listeners what I'm talking about.
Well, I actually started with the Theater Guild as an actor. I started in 1975. I auditioned for a play called Summer of the 17th Doll for Norm McPhee, and I was cast in that show, and I became fast friends with Norm McPhee, which most people do when they meet him, and I kind of was stuck forever. I was the technical director for the Racine Theater Guild for a long time. When they built their new building over on Northwestern, I actually physically helped build it. I installed a lot of the rigging with Norm and his dad, and Frank Reisenauer, and I also did a lot of the welding with Clayton Nielsen and Norm McPhee. So my roots go way back. My parents actually met at the Theater Guild and married many, many, many years ago in the 40s. So it's a quite a family tie. My uncle Raymond was very active in the Theater Guild. My dad, Gerald Klickner. My mom, Milita Klickner. My sister, Stephanie, has been in plays at the Theater Guild. So we're a pretty tight-knit group and a pretty good family. It's the theater family. So.
Yeah, wonderful. When you were in that first play, where were you in life at that point in time, 44 years ago?
I was...
If I've done my math correctly.
20-something-year-old young guy who was studying theater at the University of Wisconsin-Parkside. I actually was studying to be an anthropologist. I wanted to go to the Olduvai Gorge and dig with the Leakeys and find prehistoric man and everything.
Whoa.
But a friend of mine, Tom Reinert, was walking along one day and asked me if I wanted to come into the scene shop and help build scenery for him. And I did, and then, like so many people who are involved with theater, I caught the bug. And then I realized, well, you know, anthropologist, working in theater, the pay is probably going to be about the same. So, but you make a lot more friends in theater than you do in anthropology. So I actually started doing theater then, and a friend of mine suggested that I try out for a play at the Theater Guild, and I did. And that was many years ago, and I was the young stud back then, so... So now I'm the old guy director. So.
The old stud. I want to ask you about your background as a director, but first explain to our listeners your connection to Wisconsin, the University of Wisconsin-Parkside, aside from the fact that you graduated from there.
I did. I graduated from there, and then I went off to graduate school for a while, and I came back, and I was looking for a job. And actually, I got a job back at the Racine Theater Guild first before I started at Parkside. Norm McPhee called me up and asked me if I would consider coming back to be the TD, which is technical director, to build all the scenery, and I did. And then I got a call from the University of Wisconsin-Parkside, and they said, we're wondering if you would like to come out here and build all the scenery for Parkside and for the Fireside in Fort Atkinson. And I said, well, yeah, I would. I would love to do that because at the Theater Guild, it's pretty much a one-man job who is in charge of everything. You get a lot of volunteers who are wonderful, and we're really grateful to have those volunteers.
Sure.
I mean, Theater Guild could not do theater without the wonderful volunteers that we have. But, you know, I was kind of lonesome, and I wanted to work with other theater professionals, so I went out to the University of Wisconsin-Parkside, and I worked there for 24 years until I retired 4 years ago, so...
Well, and that's a sweet gig in that it involved the Fireside, too, which kind of put your other foot into kind of another realm of theater.
Yeah, that was, you know, Fireside is a professional theater. The majority of the actors are all equity actors, and they get paid to be there. And, you know, they actually rehearse for 1 week. But because they're professionals, they already come in and they already know their lines. And they primarily do musicals there. So
right.
They know all the music, they know their lines, they know everything, and they're ready to go. Unlike community theater, where you get people who volunteer their time and come in. And so to put together a play, it takes us about a month.
Right.
So,
tell me about the first time that you actually undertook the responsibility of being a director of a production. When was that, and under what circumstances did you kind of make that pivot?
I actually started directing when I was at Parkside. They do a series called Fresh Ink.
Oh yeah,
which is a Reader's Theater type thing. And I started doing that, and they asked me if I would be interested in directing some plays. And what it is Reader's Theater format is the actors don't have to memorize the lines; they have to become very familiar with them. But we don't use costumes and props and scenery and all of that. And they get up and they perform, but they actually hold the scripts and read. And
right.
So I did several of those for Parkside, and it was a lot of fun.
It's a great series. As far as I know, it's still going on.
It is
and,
still going on.
And, of course, what makes it especially noteworthy is, in many cases, I think it involves works that might not even be released for full staged productions, but they are available for this kind of staged reading. And in other cases, it sometimes plays that Parkside would not choose to fully stage for one reason or another, and yet it's something worth sharing with an audience, and it's probably a really valuable experience for the young actors that are part of it.
Yeah, that's correct. A lot of times it is new playwrights and new works of art that have just come out and not been released to the general public yet, or it is sometimes, like you said, some plays that for whatever reason, maybe the scenery and the costumes, something like The Madness of King George, which has like 40, 50 performers in it. It's just something, you know, you just can't do. But it's really quite a lot of fun, and the kids do learn an awful lot from that. And it also gives young performers a chance to perform without the whole, you know, all the regalia that goes with it, and they can just concentrate on the words and performing them to the best of their abilities.
So what productions have you directed at the Racine Theater Guild?
Let's see. I did, well, right now I'm doing Wait Until Dark. I did Vanya and Sonia and Masha and Spike. I did the complete Greek myths in 99 minutes or less, which was a lot of fun. And then I did, what was the first one I did? I don't know, something about a murder. It was another murder mystery. I can't off the top of my head remember what that one was because it was a while ago. But again, it was, you know, for some reason, Doug assigns me these murder mysteries or these thriller type plays that are just kind of fun to do. So,
and since you mentioned it, I just can't resist the urge to have you tell our listeners about a really memorable moment, really probably in the history of the Guild, which unfortunately sprang out of something very unfortunate that occurred on the stage, but also led to, you know, kind of a remarkable moment for you. I'm talking about one of the performances of Vanya and Sonia and Masha and Spike, one of my favorite plays. My wife and I saw it on Broadway, and we were thrilled when the Guild did it, and we enjoyed the Guild's production. But tell our listeners what happened at one, I think, Sunday afternoon matinee of that play.
Yeah, it was quite exciting. One of our performers, in fact, the man playing Vanya, for whatever reason, we're still to this day not quite sure, and neither is he, got ill. He started to faint on stage, and he couldn't go on. And it's funny because the young actress Tina Poxdellis, who was playing opposite at the time, got to utter one of the greatest theater lines of all time: "Is there a doctor in the house?"
Right.
So she stood up and yelled that, and there wasn't. But there was a nurse, and they took care of him. And Doug and I were down there on stage with the cast, and we had to stop the show. And Doug was saying, "Well, I guess we're going to have to stop the show and refund everybody their money." And I said, "Well, no, we're not going to do that." I said, "I directed the play. I'm familiar with the blocking. I don't have the lines memorized, but if you give me a script, I'll do the part." And so I did. And it's been many, many years since I've been on the Theater Guild stage, but I had a great time. It was funny because the actresses and the actors that I was playing opposite on stage would give me little cues with their eyes or nod their heads, telling me, "You're supposed to move to the right now," yeah, or "move to the left." And so I would follow along, and they helped me, and it was great. It was quite a thrilling thing for myself and the actors on stage. And the audience apparently loved it because we got a standing ovation. So mm-hmm. it was exciting, and it was kind of scary all at the same time. But the character playing Vanya, Bill, is okay now, and it's never happened to him again, and he just doesn't know what happened, and nobody knows. So,
wow. Well, we're glad
he's
that
okay.
Glad that has a happy ending.
Yeah.
I'm speaking on the morning show today at this portion of the program with Michael Klickner, longtime part of the theater faculty at the University of Wisconsin Parkside, and a longtime member of the Racine Theater Guild family, and he has been back there as a guest director on several different occasions, and most recently for a play called Wait Until Dark by Frederick Knott, which we're going to be talking about now for the next few minutes. Michael, explain the invitation to direct Wait Until Dark. Is it a case of you have all these plays that are possible and you choose the one or the ones that are most intriguing to you, or were you specifically asked to direct this production?
The answer to that question is yes. there are many, many plays that we look at, and Doug, who is the artistic managing director of the Racine Theater Guild, tries to figure out. We have several guest directors, and he figures out what would be a good fit for each director, and he asks us if we would consider. He asked me if I would consider Wait Until Dark, and I said, "Yeah, I would love to do Wait Until Dark." And there were a couple of others that I was interested in, but we have some other guest directors, and so he wanted to spread the talent and the time around. So so Doug asked me, and it was a little bit daunting for me because, as you had mentioned, this play had been done quite a while ago at the Guild. In fact, it had been done about 25 years ago when Doug first joined the Guild. This was the play he did. Mm. So I'm working under Doug's watchful eye, and I'm trying to do my best to make it brand new and fresh and everything. And I think I've done that. I as a director, I don't like to see other productions before I do them. I try not to watch the movies and things because I keep telling the actors, I know there's blocking and things written in the script. Ignore all that. That's somebody else's production. That's not us. So I try to come at it from a fresh, brand new eye. And I'm certain it's completely different than when Doug did it. I know a lot of the actors who were in his production are coming back to see it. So hopefully they'll be pleased.
So explain to our listeners, for anyone who has not seen the Audrey Hepburn film that I mentioned from which was made in 1967, explain the essential plot of this play, which I believed opened on Broadway the year before in 1966.
Sure. There's a young photographer whose name is Sam, and he has his wife whose name is Susie, and Susie unfortunately is blind. She had an accident about a year ago, so she's been blind for a little over a year, and they marry, and he somehow or other meets a woman at an airport in Montreal, Canada, and she gives him a doll to bring home. She says it's for a young girl in a hospital, and so he takes the doll and he brings it home, and he's got it somewhere in his apartment, or so we assume. And then it turns out that the doll is not an ordinary doll, that it actually happens to be full of heroin. And so she's shipping it back to the United States, and that was in the day before, you would have to go through all kinds of scanners and drug dogs and all of that stuff. So he's able to bring this doll home, and he's got it. And then these three con men who are, we assume they're nice guys, but it turns out they're not very nice at all. And they come to retrieve the doll because they know that it's worth about $50,000 in the 60s worth of money. So,
which is a lot of money then.
Which was a lot of money back then. And so they go through the process of trying to convince Susie that they're friends of her husband and that they're there to get this doll and help him get it to the right people. And at first she buys into it and she really thinks that they are there to help her. And she's a very sweet, very nice young woman. And it turns out that they have nothing but malicious intent, and they want the doll, and they're willing to get it at any price whatsoever, including actually murdering one another. So it takes course in the place of one night when we see all of this intrigue happen, and that the people are trying to find the doll, and initially she doesn't know that they're bad guys, but then she finally comes, slowly realizes these are not good guys, and they're there with bad intent. And so she, even though she's blind, and I think this is really relevant in today's world, is a very strong woman, it turns out. And with the aid of a 12-year-old girl, they con the con men, and they get their revenge in the end. And she actually ends up winning. They don't get the doll, and all the bad guys are disposed of, shall we say. So that's basically, in a nutshell, what it is. She has a doll. They want the doll. She doesn't give them the doll. They try to take the doll, and she says, you're not having the doll.
Right. I have seen the play, but it was way back when Doug directed it, so quite a long time ago. And I've seen the film several times. From what I remember of seeing the play and the movie are quite similar. In other words, the film is very true to the play. I'm assuming at some point you've seen the movie, even though you probably didn't make a point of it, as you prepared this. But am I correct about that?
Yes, I've seen the movie. And the thing that I really love about this particular play is the very first scene, they show you the three bad guys and they tell you who they are and what they're about. And so as an audience member, you know that these are not good guys. So you're kind of like, don't trust them, Susie. Don't trust them. But she does because she doesn't know what we know.
Right.
And it's very Alfred Hitchcockian in that regard. Sure. That he shows you the problem right up front, but the people in the play don't know the problem.
Right. And, of course, it really has not, at least initially, it doesn't have all that much to do with her being blind. I mean,
not really.
It's the kind of thing that just about anybody might be lulled into initially believing somebody. The fact that she is blind of course, makes it possible for their deception to occur
right.
maybe more blatantly on many different levels, and it only heightens our tension about
right.
how can she possibly extricate herself from what
right.
is obviously an extremely dangerous situation.
Right. Well, you know, and it really, I mean, the play is also partnering with the Neighborhood Watch. And we're going to have people there to explain how not to get duped by con men and watch out for the scams and the things that are out there. And I'm sure we've all had them. I mean, I just a couple of days ago got a call from the Social Security office telling me that they were going to send the cops after me if I did not send them so much money via Bitcoin or whatever right away. And I'm like, well, first of all, the IRS or the Social Security, either one of them, never ever call you. Never.
Right.
And they wouldn't say if they were professionals, well, the cops are going to get you. It's like, so we will partner with Neighborhood Watch, and they will be there and help people out.
As I think we mentioned, this play was actually written back in 1966, so more than a half century ago. Are there any ways in which this production is an update where, for instance, we're seeing more modern technology or anything else, or are you leaving it essentially in the year in which it was written?
Yeah, we actually left it in the year in which it was written. We just thought that would be kind of fun. It was tricky because, you know, there's a washing machine that plays pretty prominent in the play, and I tried my best to find a front-loading 1966 washing machine. I didn't have a lot of success in that, but we did find a washing machine that'll work for us. And everybody I talked to says, well, I've got one with ringers on top of it, and I can give you that. And I'm like, no, it's got to load from the front just for the purpose of the play. But we actually kept it in 1966. So
I suppose I know one of the most dramatic moments, I think, is when the phone line gets physically cut, and that wouldn't work too well if we shift from that to cell phones and so on. So there
right.
are certain things where it really needs to be
right.
Where it was written. Well, of course, one of the most intriguing technical challenges, I should think, for both you and for the woman portraying the role of Susie, Samantha Sustacek, is the matter of portraying somebody blind in a way that is fully convincing. First of all, is that a challenge you've ever had as a stage director to try to direct someone to be convincing in that respect?
It was a challenge for me, but fortunately for me, I have a friend, Bonnie Peterson, who happens to be blind.
Oh, from Parkside.
From Parkside. You know Bonnie Peterson. So I spoke to her a lot about it, and I asked her, I said, would she be stumbling and bumbling and fumbling around? And Bonnie said, no. She says, no. I said, well, is she counting steps? And she said, no, we don't do that. We kind of sort of have like an echo system, and we just sort of know where things are, and especially in our own homes. Because we live there, we know where everything is. And we sighted people are very much the same way. We know where things are, you know, even in the dark, so we don't go crashing into things. There are some moments and times when she's a bit disoriented. But really, I mean, she does amazingly well. And Sam is just a sweet young actress. And she was really fun to work with. And the whole cast is really enjoyable and fun to work with. They're really dedicated. I mean, and they worked really hard. One of our main crooks got gastritis and was out for a couple of days, but he's back and everything's good with him. So you know, but Sam does a really good job. And luckily, as I said, I was able to speak to someone who actually is blind and told us about being blind. So,
I think one of the most intriguing characters, you've mentioned her briefly, is that of Gloria, who is a young girl. I think she's supposed to be 11 or 12.
Well,
or
she's 12 in our production. Originally in the play, when it was first produced on Broadway, the girl was 9.
Ah.
But, you know, I don't have a lot of professional 9-year-old actors around, so I upped the age a little bit. So we made her 12. And our actress is Grace Nelson, and it's really funny because when she came to audition, she already had the entire part of Gloria memorized. You know, most actors come to a cold reading and they're not ready, but she stood up there and didn't even hold the script or anything. She knew exactly
wow.
where we were and knew all the lines and everything. And she's her dad and her mom just said she's having so much fun that it's going to break her heart when the production is over because she won't be able to play with all of her friends anymore.
Yeah.
You know,
it's an intriguing role, it seems to me, because
she's a character who comes off, especially kind of towards the beginning, is kind of bratty.
She is a little brat, no doubt about it. Definitely
And ultimately she becomes kind of a life-saving ally of Susie.
Correct.
And actually instrumental in all of this working out well in the end. But it seems to me that it's a tricky part to play because of that.
It is, and Gloria does a pretty good job of it. I mean, Grace, I keep calling her Gloria because that's her character's name.
Right.
But Grace does a pretty good job of it, and, you know, because I said, like, she really is only 12 years old, and she's doing a really, really nice job. But you're right. She does, she really kind of sort of saves Susie's life. It's funny because Susie sets out what they're going to do, and Gloria really gets into it. Like, this is really a fascinating, fun game to her because she doesn't really realize at first that it's a matter of life and death. It's just fun for her. And she says, "Ooh, I wish something like this would happen every day." I don't want something like this to happen every day. So
right, it's actually a terrible ordeal, but a young child views it through very different eyes.
But I do like it because, as I said earlier on, it really empowers women. It's the blind woman who is an adult and a 12-year-old girl, and they are very strong characters in the play, and they can take care of themselves.
Right. What about the matter of the fact that there's a fair amount of violence in this play? And a couple of different characters, without giving too much away, a couple of different characters are murdered, I would presume, right before our eyes. They certainly are murdered right before our eyes in the film. And what about those kind of matters from maybe almost a sort of a technical point of view? How does one handle that to make that convincing, persuasive?
Well, we work it. You choreograph it kind of like a dance. There's actually four murders in the play. The first one happens before the play even starts, and we don't see that one. Mm. There's one. One of the bad guys is killed off stage. He's run over by a car. And then there are two that are killed on stage, and we see it. One is killed by one of the other bad guys. You know, that's the problem with bad guys is there's no loyalty among thieves. They bump one another off so that instead of part of the money, they get all of the money. And then Susie kills the last one. And it's choreography, and we took a little time with it. And actually in the play, part of it is in complete, total blackness, complete blackout. I turn off the aisle lights and everything so nobody can see. So the whole entire audience is thrust into Susie's world. And because she is a non-sighted person, she can move around freely because she moves around in the dark all the time. But the bad guy is having a hard time moving around.
Hmm. So that becomes an equalizer.
It does. It definitely
and
does.
And if anything, it puts her in the advantage because she knows that space in a way that these crooks do not.
Exactly. There's a couple of really nice scenic moments that I really love when the actors actually light matches, and that's the only light on stage. And it really looks – it's a pretty powerful ending, I think.
Wow. So does the audience have to be warned that this is going to be the situation?
We're not going to warn anybody about anything. They're going to be thrust into the dark.
Because sometimes if there's like a flashing strobe or something, there'll be signs in the lobby.
Or gunshots or any of that. But, no, we're just going to throw them into the dark. I mean, the play is called Wait Until Dark, so they'll just have to wait.
There you go. I recently read that when Wait Until Dark was in movie theaters in its initial run, that at least in some theaters would turn off all of the lights or progressively all of the lights so the auditorium itself would be plunged in complete darkness at that point in the movie when everything goes dark. I thought that would be an amazing experience, and now it sounds like that's what we will have at the Guild as
you
well.
You will definitely have that at the Guild. I mean, you worked at the Guild. You know that even in the tunnels underneath where we turn off all the lights down there too, so there's hardly any light whatsoever on stage. The only little bit of light that actually happens comes from our sound and light booth, but only because those people who are calling the cues and things, they need to be able to see.
Yeah, right.
But because the audience has been watching it, it's dark.
Wow.
It's scary. So
cool. Well, I'm actually going to be seeing your opening night performance tonight, and I'm very, very excited about that. And we want to remind everybody that there are several weekends of performances available at the Racine Theater Guild of this terrific play called Wait Until Dark by Frederick Knott. If people are interested in getting tickets, what do they do?
They should just call the Racine Theater Guild's box office and talk to one of the young ladies in the box office, and they'll set you up.
There you go. So 633-4218 is the box office phone number, and otherwise racinetheater.org is the address of the website. And the director of their current production opening tonight, Wait Until Dark, Michael Klickner. Michael Klickner, great to talk with you again. Best wishes to you and your whole cast for Wait Until Dark.
Thank you.
The time is 8:41. You're listening to the Friday Morning Show on WGTD-HD, your gateway to public radio. I'm Gregory Berg, and here's part two of today's program. Music of Russian composer Sergei Rachmaninoff and played by my esteemed faculty colleague Dr. Wael Farouk, director of keyboard studies at Carthage College. He is a force of nature at the piano, and the many concerts that he has played since coming to Carthage have been nothing short of amazing. His next performance is coming up this Sunday afternoon, February 24th, 3 o'clock, at First United Methodist Church, that's on the corner of Sheridan Road and 60th Street in Kenosha. He will be playing a recital that's part of the Fine Arts at First series. He will be playing the mighty Busendorfer Grand Piano in the sanctuary of First United Methodist, one of the finest pianos in southeastern Wisconsin. And he will be offering up an all-Russian program that is sure to delight everyone in the audience. He will be playing a work by Mili Balakirev, The Lark. He will be playing the second piano sonata of Sergei Rachmaninoff. And after a brief intermission, he will offer up pictures at an exhibition by Modest Mussorgsky. I want to play for you a brief excerpt from the first interview, which I recorded with Dr. Farouk, not long after he began work at Carthage College, shortly before the very first recital that he played on campus. In this interview, he tells us just a little bit about his fascinating story.
Well, originally, I come from Cairo, Egypt. I was born there, and we're Coptic Christians, and I grew there and lived in Cairo till I was 21, and then I moved to the States for graduate studies. I joined the Cairo Conservatory when I was 7 and had wonderful teachers, although I was not accepted first at the conservatory since I had a very small hand size, and they were quite concerned about me surviving as a pianist or making it even past the early years of my piano studies. So anyway,
I would say you proved them wrong.
Thank you very much. You're very kind. Well, I was stubborn, and luckily had great support from my parents, who knew nothing about music, but also providentially had a great teachers that they really helped me, and I owe them everything. So.
You mentioned that you have hands that are smaller than we typically see for a concert pianist, but it clearly is nothing that presents a any kind of a hindrance to you. Are there, in fact, ways in which relatively small hand size is any kind of advantage or has worked as an advantage for you in any way?
Yeah. Well, I definitely believe so. However, I think it's somewhat of a myth that you have to have a giant size hand in order to be a good pianist. I think if we look at some of the great pianists like Joseph Hoffman or Godofsky or Lewenthal, all of those people did not really have giant hands at all. And for instance, someone like Rachmaninoff, who had an enormous hand, considered Joseph Hoffman to be much greater pianist than himself. So I think it's every single hand has its issues. You know, everyone complained about their hands. Rachmaninoff did. Even Franz Liszt did. Even Chopin did a little bit. So and every hand has its own challenges, but I think that's part of our individuality, our selectiveness of repertoire, our directions, whatever you want to call it. On more practical note, I hear many people with larger hands complain about their hands getting in the way. For instance, in chords or octaves, which you think they will, you know, be happy or grateful that they have large hands, or small passages that, you know, their fingers. I heard, I know for a fact, since my teacher was a good, was a classmate of Richter, actually, Sviatoslav Richter, that he always complained about his fingers getting stuck between the keys playing some of the Chopin etudes, opus 10. So every hand has its own, you know, advantages and minuses. So.
An excerpt from my very first morning show conversation with Dr. Wael Farouk shortly after he became a part of the music faculty at Carthage College. During that first morning show encounter, I was privileged to hear Dr. Farouk play an excerpt from Rachmaninoff's famous Vocalise as transcribed for solo piano.
Delicious, and it's so interesting to hear a piece of music we know so well in its original guise or closer to its original form in this particular way. Do you enjoy playing transcriptions?
Oh, so much. And who wouldn't enjoy playing Beethoven symphonies on the piano or something like the Vocalise or Schubert songs that at least transcribed? And if you think of it, almost everything that was written before 1720 that we play today is a transcription of some sort, because it's either written for organ or harpsichord or clavichord. Or
that's right, no piano.
Yes, even Beethoven's piano, even Chopin's piano is a lot different than we have. So there is kind of transcription-esque there, too.
Right.
So. You're listening to the Friday Morning Show on WGTD. I'm Gregory Berg. We're replaying some excerpts from my very first morning show conversation with Dr. Wael Farouk from the music faculty at Carthage College, because he's going to be playing a piano recital this Sunday afternoon, 3 o'clock, at First United Methodist Church in Kenosha as part of their Fine Arts at First series. First United Methodist is located at the corner of Sheridan Road and 60th Street, and he will be playing the mighty Busendorfer grand piano that adorns the sanctuary of First United Methodist Church, in a program that promises to be very memorable. It's an all-Russian program, music of Balakirev and Rachmaninoff in the first half, and in the second half, one of the monumental masterworks of the 19th century, Pictures at an Exhibition by Russian composer Modest Mussorgsky. This is a work that is almost always heard nowadays in its orchestral transcription. Several different composers transcribed this work for orchestra to dazzling effect, but actually Mussorgsky conceived the work as a work for solo piano. This work was composed as a tribute to a friend of Mussorgsky's, artist, architect, and designer Victor Hartmann. They had been friends for some years, and then Hartmann died quite suddenly in the summer of 1873 from an aneurysm. It was a sudden loss that left Mussorgsky deeply, deeply shaken. Hartmann was only 39 years old at the time of his death, and Mussorgsky found himself spiraling downward into depression and despair. A memorial exhibition of over 400 of Hartmann's works was put together at the Imperial Academy of Arts in St. Petersburg. And Mussorgsky actually lent a couple of his own copies of the works of Hartmann to that exhibition. And he viewed that exhibition in person. And Mussorgsky then composed Pictures at an Exhibition in honor of his dear friend. It's among the most famous works of its time. And I want to have you listen to one of the movements of Pictures at an Exhibition, from the recording of it made by Dr. Wael Farouk himself, a marvelous album called Russian Portraits. Again, this is Dr. Wael Farouk himself playing a movement from Pictures and an Exhibition of Mussorgsky. A scintillating excerpt from Modest Mussorgsky's Pictures at an Exhibition.
which will be the second half of an all-Russian piano recital played this Sunday afternoon at 3 o'clock by Dr. Wael Farouk, Director of Keyboard Studies at Carthage College. This is part of the Fine Arts at First series at First United Methodist, which is at the corner of Sheridan Road and 60th Street. Dr. Farouk will be playing the mighty Busendorfer grand piano in the sanctuary of First United Methodist. Over the last several years that Dr. Farouk has been a part of the music faculty at Carthage, he has presented an astonishing array of recitals, including one especially memorable night in which he performed all five piano concertos of Ludwig van Beethoven with orchestra in a single evening. It was an astonishing performance, the likes of which I have never seen in my life. To finish out the hour today, here is an excerpt drawn from Dr. Farouk's website of him live in performance playing the monumental piano concerto number 3 of Sergei Rachmaninoff's, whose music will be featured prominently with his second piano sonata in Sunday afternoon's recital. And again, the public is warmly invited to attend what promises to be a magnificent afternoon of music making. My thanks to Dr. Wael Farouk for the memorable conversations we have had over the years, and I look forward to Sunday afternoon's recital at 3 o'clock for the Fine Arts at First series. We're approaching 9 o'clock here on WGTD. Monday on the morning show, Dr. Art Sear pays his monthly visit to the program to offer analysis of current events. Tuesday, Brian Albrecht, the president of Gateway Technical College, with his monthly visit.